Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer.
And I'm Gregor Robertson. We're here with you twice a week throughout the season for all the best reaction and analysis from some of the best football writers in the business.
Joining us today in the studio, it is The Times' very own James Gearbrandt. Coming up, we'll look ahead to another busy week of Champions League action, but first to Old Trafford. And before we get on to our lovely old friend VAR, let's take a look at the match as a whole, as Adam Lallana's late equaliser saved a point for an under-par Liverpool as they drew 1-1 at Manchester United. Away from the controversy that is VAR, Liverpool without Mo Salah looked unusually nervy, with Marcus Rashford and Daniel James causing them defensive problems up and down the flanks. Now, the result moves United into 13th, 7 points off the top four, while Liverpool see their lead at the top cut to 6 points, and it of course ends their winning streak in the league, halted now at 17 games in a row, one victory short of equaling Manchester City's record. But James, does this result prove Liverpool lack a strength in depth in any way?
I didn't think Liverpool played very well at all. Certainly not for the first kind of hour of the match. I thought it was so funny watching this match, and you're talking about a team in Liverpool who are, I think, probably one of the two best teams in Europe, one of the two best, most well-coached teams in Europe, obviously European champions, obviously, as we all know, on this incredibly long winning streak in the Premier League. And it just, for me, was kind of a snapshot into how frustrating it must be to coach a team, because even at that kind of, you know, peak of excellence that Liverpool are at, the team actually really didn't function very well for the first kind of hour of this match. They looked really kind of uncertain as to how, didn't really kind of have a sort of, you know, method of, you know, means of creating chances, didn't really know how they were going to kind of progress the ball into the kind of, you know, into the penalty box, into the final third. You know, you sort of ended up with kind of Alexander-Arnold kind of crossing it from positions that were far too deep, or they would kind of try to smuggle it through the middle, but they wouldn't quite be able to get it through. So I didn't feel Liverpool played well, but they did obviously, I think, improve as the kind of second half wore on, and I think they finished the match quite strongly. I mean, do they lack strength in depth? Yes, to an extent. I mean, obviously, in those forward positions, your backups are obviously Origi, who played yesterday. Obviously, you've got likes of Shaqiri as well. I mean, you know, look, they're not Man City. They're not PSG in terms of the kind of, you know, the sort of elite quality that they have backing up those positions. I think one other thing to mention is that this for me was a match that Naby Keita was, you know, obviously they signed Naby Keita at the kind of summer before this last summer, and for me, I would have expected Keita to have maybe be at a higher level or to be, you know, to have kicked on more than he has done. For me, this was a match where he could really have played, because I think obviously you lost a little bit from not having Salah, and so I think, you know, had you played Keita instead of Henderson, that would maybe have given the team a better balance, a bit more threat from midfield. Obviously, it would have been much easier to kind of, you know, would have given you a bit more flexibility to change to the 4-2-3-1, which they tried to do. And obviously, Henderson ended up playing on the right, which looked very unnatural. I kind of feel like there's more to come from him, but I think maybe he's not. Yeah, it's a game where I think they would have, you know, maybe like to start him, but...
Well, after the match, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and Marcus Rashford suggested that they were disappointed at not holding on for the win. But, Gregor, will they see any positives going forward from this game?
Absolutely, just in the sheer fact that everyone predicted that Liverpool were going to walk all over them. And it didn't work out that way in any way or shape or form. I think Manchester United deserve real credit for the way they set up tactically and their performance in the first half. You know, I think Liverpool were probably caught a little bit by surprise. But with the energy and sort of and gumption that Manchester United showed at the start, they were really right in their faces. And also with the fact that they deployed Rashford and James on either wing, and everyone talks about how to negate Liverpool's fullbacks. And, you know, they were talking about that in the studio beforehand. And I don't think anyone really predicted that really the two people who thought were going to be centre forward would almost be playing on the wing. And it worked very well in the first half. But I think we also have to qualify it with saying they had like 32% possession. This is Manchester United at home in a kind of iconic fixture. And, we were starting from a low expectation of them, and yes, they exceeded that, and it was a positive performance. They could have won, but still, this is Manchester United at home, and it's not what we expect.
Well, let's bring in the Times chief sports writer Matt Dickinson, who was at Old Trafford yesterday, joins us now. Matt, Jurgen Klopp after the game was left frustrated by United's tactics. He said one team set out to defend and one team made the game. Is there anything wrong with United's tactics, or do you think this is just sour grapes from Klopp?
I was about to call him peevish, churlish yesterday until he sort of qualified it by saying, you know, Liverpool had caused themselves a lot of problems in the first half, because I thought, you know, ultimately, you know, you're coming as a champions. Liverpool were odds on. I mean, I got I couldn't resist a little flutter on Man U to win 1-0 at 12-1 at home, which is just ridiculous, you know, sort of crazy odds when you're talking about this giant of a club. I think Solskjaer was, you know, allowed, any manager is, but particularly in these circumstances, to come up with a game plan that he thought would be effective, no matter whether that's 20%, 30%, or whatever percent possession, whatever style. I mean, as Gregor says, you know, that's not necessarily going to work in every game, and it's certainly not going to rebuild the United that needs to be rebuilt. But in a sort of bespoke horses for courses strategy, it took Liverpool by surprise, not just the way it was set up, but in how effective it was. And I think, Klopp obviously wanted just to make the point that, it was tough for his team, but yeah, he needed and did acknowledge that his own side fell well short of what they're capable of. And I mean, just on that strength in depth issue, I thought that was possibly the biggest boost Liverpool could take, is that each one of their substitutions made a difference and improved them. I mean, Henderson did well to last on as long as he did. Agree with, you know, I'm hoping and expecting more from Keita. I thought Oxlade-Chamberlain brought a real sort of dynamism to it that they'd lacked or were starting to lack, and obviously Lallana added the goal. So all three changes showed that at least in the sort of attacking midfield sort of options, they have got some useful choices that he'll need.
As Gregor said, though, not many were expecting Manchester United to win this game. James, Henry Winter in the game today writes, defiant draw can be a turning point for Solskjaer. Do you agree with him?
United are playing a certain type of football this season. I think they're playing quite differently from how they played under Solskjaer at the back end of last season, or throughout when he was in charge last season, when they would generally play in quite open games and, yeah, they rode their luck to a certain extent, but, you know, they would, you know, kind of, their attacking talent would sort of drag them through, particularly if you remember when they were playing really well around sort of, you know, January. This season, they've been pretty defensive and they've actually defended pretty well. I mean, if you look at a lot of the stats in terms of chances conceded and expected goals conceded, they're right down the bottom, as in, you know, as in good. And they're playing in games generally that are quite tight, games of quite few chances. And they've probably been a little bit unlucky, I think. Clearly, they're not playing particularly well in attack. or indeed at all well. But obviously, there's the mitigation of they've not had Pogba or Martial. So I think in general, whether this result will be a catalyst, I mean, yes, psychologically, I think it will probably be a bit of a boost. But I think in general, there is a bit of a cause for optimism, with perhaps more so than the table would suggest. I think they're a team with a pretty solid defensive platform this season. If you look at their games, how they've played, they're not giving up a lot of chances. They're pretty solid at the back. I think Maguire and Wan-Bissaka both bedding in really well and look to be really good signings. The attack is quite poor at the moment, quite dysfunctional, but you've got Pogba and Martial to come back. And yeah, so I think I'd be surprised if they don't start to move up the table.
I mean, Rashford was back to his best. That's the biggest positive, I think, for Manchester United attacking-wise. And you kind of, with every passing game, you see the importance of Dan James as well. He's like, he's a brave little thing, isn't he? He's getting smashed all over the place and getting back up, and he's a real threat with his pace. I thought Andres Pereira had probably his best game for, certainly that I've seen in a Manchester United shirt. And even Fred sort of was, you know, he was flying into tackles doing things that weren't knocking it out of play and stuff. So, there was definitely positives for Manchester United. It's just that they aren't going to play against Liverpool, who are coming out, you know, leaving these spaces and really trying to attack them every week. They're going to be in Liverpool's position most week, trying to break down defences. And that's where Manchester United have really struggled so far this year.
It's interesting because something that Solskjaer has mentioned a lot whenever he sort of talks about, you know, the Manchester United way and how he wants to play, how he wants his team to play, is countering. And, you know, he wants his team to be really devastating on the counter-attack. And it kind of feels to me like that has sort of, that's gone from being sort of like a feature of the way they play to being quite a sort of like defining character. It's like almost like their defining kind of tactical characteristic now, that they defend pretty solidly and they will try to hit you on the break, but there's not maybe very much more than that.
And you've got to be playing against someone who allows you to, you know, who comes out and attacks you, or else there's no counter break to have.
Yeah, and I think that's why, to a certain extent, I think they look quite comfortable with that game plan yesterday. But obviously, it's, you know, it's as you say, it's how you take that into playing against, you know, teams that are not Liverpool.
Well, let's talk about VAR, shall we? Because because it is another game perhaps dogged by some controversy in this one. Jurgen Klopp says he was 100% sure VAR would disallow Marcus Rashford's opener for a foul on Divock Origi. Klopp said this: "I calmed everyone down because I knew immediately they scored the goal, and Martin Atkinson, immediately signalled VAR. Now, without VAR, I'm 100% sure Atkinson would have blown for a foul. This does not make sense. It is a clear VAR issue with how we deal with it in the moment." So, that wasn't the only decision that VAR had to get involved with. There was the Sadio Mane goal that was then chalked off for a handball from him before Adam Lallana then went on and scored that late equaliser. Matt, do we agree with the decisions that VAR came up with at Old Trafford?
I think I do. Yes, I sort of agreed with Klopp's wider point while sort of disagreeing with the specific. Just, you know, VAR so clear cut. Let's this one. Yeah, we could spend 20 minutes just on one decision here. I mean, he had a point that, you know, it is fair to ask, and this has been discussed since VAR's implementation, of the need for referees to call what they see and not to almost rely on VAR as a sort of insurance policy. You know, I'll let that possible foul go because if it's a bad, you know, if I've made a mistake, the VAR will save me. That is not how referees are told on that sort of, they're told to sort of, you know, call what they see. But, on, you know, the way... So there's a sort of broader point that Klopp was raising, which, you know, is a sort of live discussion around VAR. On the specifics of this, though, the way Martin Atkinson was refereeing that game, you know, I'm not convinced he would give it a foul. I thought it was probably a foul, but equally, the way Origi goes down, it was certainly theatrical, to say the least. Certainly looked sort of above and beyond whatever contact there was. Yeah, the way he was refereeing that game was to allow a reasonable amount of robust challenges. As a sort of Yorkshire copper, he likes to often to sort of have that style. And I think he... So I'm not, you know, I'm not convinced that he would have definitely given it. And I think, you know, we had a guidance at the start, before the start of the season, about how far they would go back. And this was certainly sort of right, stretching the limit. I mean, it was, it did set off the move. It did sort of catch Liverpool slightly off balance. So if it was a clear foul, you could say, well, yeah, it should definitely have been called back. But I think in terms of the amount of play that then went into the goal, it was sort of, say, right on the limit of how far you would ever want to go back. And I think there's just a broader point, which I guess come back to, is that ultimately, which I've sort of written this morning, is that, you know, there's a limit to how much VAR should be interfering, how much we should want it to interfere. And, you know, we come back to that issue of sort of clear blunders. I don't think this hits the threshold. So I am not... We can quibble about it. We can say it was probably a foul, possibly a foul. We can say Liverpool were a bit unlucky. But I don't think this comes down under the sort of, you know, it was a blunder, VAR has failed.
Do you think though, Matt, going back onto the point you made about insurance, that some referees may well be using VAR as an insurance, do you actually think that is happening?
I'm sure it's sort of human, yeah, just the nature of it. It can happen and it will happen. But, you know, obviously, say they're trained to sort of, you know, not make that happen where possible. I mean, obviously, linesmen, we're told, you know, told to sort of let the play run because we don't want to flag in for a potential offside that, you know, and they get it wrong. That can be called back. That's a sort of a matter of fact that can be resolved. Whereas, you know, these sort of, was that a foul, wasn't it a foul, there are always going to be grey areas. I think they, you know, they are encouraged to sort of call what they see. And I'm, you know, I say, if you line 10 people up, I don't know, would 7 out of 10 say that was a foul? Maybe, but I don't think 10 out of 10 would. And that's where, you know, that's where people have to accept that VAR is there to avoid the worst decisions, not to try and re-referee every single decision.
There is that argument as well, Matt, that perhaps David Coote, who was VAR for this game, a junior official, perhaps didn't want to overrule a senior referee when it comes to these sort of on-field subjective decisions.
Well, that's what I've seen. You know, I've seen a lot of people, and I, you know, again, it's, you know, this is all, you know, certainly what I've said all along is that, you know, we're not going to get VAR right straight away, and people should be sort of grown up enough to accept that, you know, the system. Yeah, they might not like the system as it is now, so let's talk about improving the system. You know, the issue of whether the referees should go over to the monitor, that was used, obviously, you know, we've seen that used back to the 2018 World Cup. The Premier League didn't want to go down that because they felt that the English game was sort of impatient to keep the game flowing, and that they felt that, you know, ultimately, referees work as a team. If a linesman sees something blatant, he flags and tells the referee. If a VAR sees something blatant, he can, you know, speak into a microphone and tell the referee too. So this was a way of keeping the game moving, not having the delay while the referee trots over to the monitor under that sort of pressure every time, and the two guys can communicate. And I have to say, I think that I preferred that system because I think, you know, ultimately these guys are working as a team. The VAR gets to see the replays if it's a, and also it keeps that issue of VARs only interfere when it is a clear blunder, rather than the referee constantly going back and testing his own marginal decisions. So I know why I can see why there's an argument about using the pitch side monitor, but I don't think I would suddenly do a U-turn just based on this decision. Far from it.
Gregor, where do you stand on the fact that there is the potential for referees to look at these pitch side monitors, but they're not?
I think people kind of, you know, that was an anathema earlier in this, before the season started, you know. But I think actually opinions probably going towards that, because there's so many decisions that we're seeing or people are not agreeing with, that the sort of the bigger goal of getting more correct decisions is probably that's something that people are more willing to sort of go for now. I think on Klopp's point about it being a, you know, some referees using VAR as an insurance policy almost, I think there has been incidents, particularly in and around the box, with kind of, I don't know, even, you know, potential penalty kicks and things like that, that you could see that argument. But in this case, no. I mean, it was inside Lindelof's own half when he made the challenge. And I also think, it wasn't that far back. It was because, you know, the ball was probably in the back of the net within 4 or 5 seconds. But I don't think the referee used that as an insurance policy in this case, because there was so, you know, There was so far to go. But I do think that is a potential issue.
What about, now, I don't know where all of you stand on this, but if you've been watching the Rugby World Cup, and obviously we know that they have TMO in rugby, and they're so good at communicating the decisions that they come up with in rugby, is that something we should be wanting with our own technology that we're implementing with VAR, so that actually, even though we might still not agree with the final decision, James, we actually will understand the thinking behind it all?
It does look good when they do it in rugby. The you know, the communication is clear. Would that help in football? Maybe it would, but then again, you've got the kind of issue that football is obviously kind of, it's a more fast-paced, free-flowing game. You don't have you're not kind of, as a rugby, you're sort of culturally are quite accustomed to having quite long stoppages in the game, which obviously you're not so much in football. Would that just add additional time? Maybe. I don't know. For me, I think one issue that I think they've got, in my opinion, is I don't mind the so-called high bar for intervention on stuff like fouls. Like Matt, I was pretty okay with the decisions in yesterday's match. Maybe it was a foul, but it didn't strike me as a kind of egregious error. The problem that you've got, though, is obviously you've got a completely different attitude towards offside decisions, where you have even the most kind of infinitesimal kind of offsides being kind of reviewed again and again, and you know, you can have a goal sort of ruled out, you know, literally for kind of like, you know, centimeters of somebody's shoulder. I understand conceptually why that's the case, because offside is supposedly an objective decision, whereas fouls are subjective. I understand that in theory. In practice, I think it looks absurd because you've got a policy of, you know, a kind of deliberate policy of very much non-intervention on certain kind of decisions, and a policy of absolutely kind of excruciatingly minute reviewing of other decisions. And obviously wasn't the case yesterday, but obviously there's no reason why you couldn't have, you know, two of those in the same game. I just think that to me strikes me as kind of as a kind of tension that I don't like, but I understand it. But for me, it's a bit ridiculous.
Well, VAR controversy wasn't just limited to the game at Old Trafford. Elsewhere, in Manchester City's win over Crystal Palace, Kevin De Bruyne collided with Wilfred Zaha, and a penalty wasn't given in that game. Also, in the match for Tottenham against Watford, which ended in that 1-1 draw, the company supplying the VAR technology, Hawkeye Innovations, had to apologise to both sets of fans after a graphic error during that game. That was after the Spurs midfielder Dele Alli salvaged a point for Spurs 4 minutes from time, cancelling out Abdoulaye Doucouré's opener for Watford. Now, the referee in this one was Christopher Kavanagh. He initiated this VAR check after he suspected the ball may have been handled by Alli prior to it hitting the back of the net. The goal was reviewed. The decision was made to award the goal, with the referee signalling to the players to head back to the centre circle. But instead of that being shown on the big screen, it indicated the decision was a no-goal verdict, so confusion reigned momentarily. Tottenham were also fortunate to not give away a penalty. Yann Vertonghen's challenge on Gerard Deulofeu in the box was not awarded. Do these sorts of incidents, so the confusion of graphics, the penalty that most people, I think, are saying was a penalty, give more ammunition, Gregor, to those that argue VAR as ruining the game?
I'm sure it does, yeah. it was a mistake that shouldn't really happen. But it did. I'm sure we won't see that again. I'm pretty certain of that. The biggest issue was the penalty kick that wasn't. I mean, that, I know these are, you know, everything's subjective with it when it's a foul, but that's pretty clear and pretty obvious. I think he had a couple of hooks at Deulofeu, and I can't see how that's not given. And it was. I can't see how that was not given. And really, that I think that's probably the thing that's going to give a stick to beat VAR with the most. These incidents where really the bar seems so high that really it's almost non-existent now.
Matt, just a final word from you then on that particular incident. As Gregor has said, and everyone's been mentioning this high bar, is that what that would have come down to? Because it did seem quite clear-cut, that penalty.
Yeah, I think that was one of the more obvious Well, it seems to be one of the more obvious sort of errors of the simple, you know, human errors rather than VAR errors, because ultimately that does come down to the human implementation of it. I think like Gregor, I thought that was odd. That's the human error, not the system. And I think that's, you know, how many times have we talked about this, of just that need to accept that the system is, you know, it never was going to be this perfect system. It never could be. It never was going to clear everything up. It never was going to put everything right. It was there to, because in the modern world that we're living in, it seems pretty odd to have a bloke running around making mistakes, making some huge mistakes all the time, when we can help him not make those mistakes. And if we sort of just try and occasionally pause for breath and remember what the overall aim is and what the gains can be, then, you know, we don't have to sort of lurch from, you know, oh, let's change the system just because one decision didn't quite fit what we thought it should be.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, an FA Cup tie was abandoned after Haringey Borough's manager took his team off the field amid accusations of racism, bottle throwing and spitting. The home keeper, Valerie Douglas-Pagetat, was reportedly spat at and hit by an object thrown from the Yeovil town end. Defender Kobe Rowe was then racially abused, according to the Haringey boss, Tom Loizu, who said there was no way I could let him continue and that if we get punished and thrown out, I don't care. The match was played at non-league side Haringey's home ground of Coles Park Stadium, and it was the fourth qualifying round of the FA Cup, with the winner set to progress to the first round proper. Now, in the game today, Matt Lawton and Tom Roddy reflect on this shocking incident, and Tom joins us now. Tom, thank you for joining us on what is another hideous incident of racism in football. Just a few days ago, we were talking about the worrying troubles for England in Bulgaria, and now a game here in England has had to be abandoned due to this racist abuse.
Yes, I was going to say that. It's a kind of a timely reminder, and you and I have been speaking about this quite often, as out in Bulgaria, talking about England and Gareth Southgate's experiences with racism, and this is just a timely reminder of the issues at home. Kobe Rowe spoke really quite eloquently yesterday about the experiences, about the fact this is the first time he's experienced it in English football, and it was an unprecedented step for a professional or semi-professional side to walk off the field that game at Haringey. And it's now kind of up to the FA as to how they'll deal with it, and we're not sure how it's going to pan out. We expect that the sanctions will be placed on individuals rather than the club as a whole, because of the precedent it could set.
It's I'm sort of looking at the article that you've written, Tom, and there was an incident in non-league football with Paddingham FC of the North West Counties Football League. They left the field in protest, alleged racist abuse during a game against Congleton Town in October of last year. Both clubs were actually charged by the FA as a result of this, and it was the club that left the field for the racist abuse that they were suffering that were fined more than the team that the fans came from.
Yes. Yeah, it's remarkable, really.
Yeah.
Exactly. Paddy M were fined £165, while Congleton were fined £160. So I don't think we'll see that happen again in this instance. I think it's also interesting to point out the protocol for these racist incidents, because it's very similar. The SA, the Premier League, the EFL, their protocol for dealing with allegations of racism at games is exactly the same, or extremely very similar to UEFA's three-step protocol, in which the first instance, players and the manager inform the referee that then the game is brought to a halt and an announcement is made, as it was in Sofia last week. The second instance is where the game is suspended for a certain amount of time, and in the FA's wording, it is a reasonable amount of time before the game continues. And then the third is where the referee will abandon the game if the calls for the issues to stop, the abuse to stop, is unheeded. But he can only do that following consultation with police and a safety officer.
And what's interesting about that is that, and forgive my ignorance, I might not know this very well, but in non-league games, I'm guessing police won't be heavily involved.
No, exactly that. And also there are the FA's guidelines are that also EFL representatives are consulted before a referee makes that kind of decision. But again, they're unlikely to be at all the games. So it is up to the referee who will have the final say.
I mean, Gregor, when you hear the protocol that is in place, it does seem a little outdated in some ways.
It does, and it's just extraordinary that it seems really in the last few months something that's been around for the best part of a decade is becoming, you know, something that we're aware of and talking of. And I would say that would be the same of players and managers and most people involved in the game. And obviously, if England hadn't raised this issue and did what they did in Bulgaria, even though they didn't walk off the pitch, you know, it was a huge, huge statement and big reaction, this wouldn't have happened. I'm certain of that. But the sad—I mean, like the saddest thing, above all of, we're trying to talk about an issue that is sort of a societal issue, and football cannot tackle it on its own. There's no way that football can do the best it can to try and protect the players on the pitch and to try and drive out anyone who ban anyone who is found to have done anything like this. But really, you're tackling something that's far bigger than football, and I think really we have to acknowledge that there's no easy fix to this. People saying that, you know, this is great that they've walked off the pitch. This is absolutely great, but I don't know. It brings awareness of the issue, and no one should have to deal with what the player did on the pitch. But it's not a quick fix.
Tom, just finally with you, is there any suggestion that Yeovil could be ejected from the FA Cup as a result of this?
I think it's extremely unlikely. The issue that the FA see is that it could set a precedent for clubs going forward, that there's the danger that you could see people teased in, and then it ends up with a club being kicked out of the cup. So I think the issue is how they go about punishing the club and Yeovil and the individuals, and that'll be interesting thing. We'll see.
James, let me ask you, how much credit do we need to give to both Haringey and Yeovil? Because this was a collective decision. The Haringey boss, Loizu, has said that when speaking to Yeovil, they said they tried to calm their supporters down. They tried their best and they supported us. They said, if you're walking off, we are walking off with you.
Yeah, I think the clubs deserve credit. I think, you know, that sort of solidarity obviously is good to hear of in the face of such, you know, appalling abuse. As Gregor said, it's obviously just, you know, it's depressing that this, you know, is now seemingly, you know, I don't want to sort of, I don't believe in sort of, you know, kind of, not from, you know, I think it's my place to sort of, you know, preach and say that, you know, players should always walk off or players shouldn't walk off. For me, you know, that's, you know, an individual decision very much to be taken by the players that, you know, are subjected to the abuse. Some players may want to play on and prove a point, and or, you know, some players may have a completely opposite reaction, and I think that that's completely fine. I just, it's obviously so depressing that we're obviously at a point now where this has become seemingly so, obviously not common, but, you know, obviously it's common enough that we're sort of having to kind of, you know, talk about protocols and sort of, you know, codifying a sort of response to it, which is just depressing, really.
And I know I asked Tom there about the possibilities of Yeovil being kicked out of the FA Cup as a result of this. Once again, the Haringey manager has said that he doesn't want that to happen. He doesn't want Yeovil Town to get punished for it. He says if we get thrown out of the FA Cup and they go through, there is no hard feelings as well. So he's aware there could be repercussions for Haringey walking off. But what do you think should happen? Should this be replayed and it just does come down to the individuals?
Yeah, I mean, that's the ideal scenario. And it's very different to Bulgaria. Bulgaria were serial offenders. That's why I said in the last pod that they should be thrown out. They've shown very little willingness to tackle an issue. This is well abhorrent. It is a handful of fans, perhaps. We don't even know how many fans that have directed something very personally and in close proximity to someone on the pitch. And I don't think that, you know, I don't think that has any bearing on Yeovil Town Football Club. I don't think that they should really be punished for that. And I know there'll be people who disagree. There'll be people who think that, you know, taking a hard line, if, you know, that's the only way you're going to stop the fans, the supporters of your club, because it could get your club thrown out of the competition. I get that. But I also think that there's, you know, then it opens up the possibility of it being abused. And it's not an easy topic to tackle. And it is bigger than football. It's something that, you know, I think if you deny the kind of political climate, I know it's a football podcast, but you deny that and the sort of an emboldened far right across Europe, then you're living in the clouds, because that is something that, we're seeing more incidents, not just in football, we're seeing them on the streets. And this is a bigger issue than football.
Well, it's time to round up the EFL. And Gregor, you've continued your tour of the country's Football League grounds. And this weekend, you've been to see how Reading got on after they sacked Jose Gomez and then replaced him with their sporting director, Mark Bowen. That was a bit controversial in itself. But you've written about this. It's at the back of the game. And life under Bowen began with a dramatic last gasp winner.
It did, yeah. It was an awful game. I mean, really terrible. Preston North End, they were playing high flying up the top of the championship, and they were awful as well. Alex Ray afterwards was not pleased. But Reading will not care, you know. I think they'd lost five out of the last six league games, I think. And having just sacked Josie Gomez, it was... And the controversy of the last week, obviously, the situation was Mark Rowan was the sporting director, and he had begun to draw up a short list of managers, and then was offered the position himself.
Is this before any interview process then? As you say, he drew...
Yep, there was no interviews at all.
Okay.
So it was a surprise to him, it was a surprise to the fans, it was a surprise to most people, really. And he's been a number two to Mark Hughes in the Premier League and with Wales for the best part of two decades. So he's not, you know, he's not a suit sitting upstairs. He is someone who can work on the training ground. But really, just in the broader context of Reading, it's, you know, the fan base are growing pretty disillusioned there, because ever since Majeski, the former owner, sold up after 22 years, that was back in kind of 2012, they've had Russian owner who treated the club a bit like a kind of plaything with his father's money. A Thai consortium who sold the club and after kind of completing a bit of a land grab with a development in mind next to the stadium. And now Chinese owners who have never appeared in public, really, or spoken publicly anyway. And... who have now got sacked three managers in the last 18 months. And the strange thing was that Josie Gomez was loved by the supporters. He came in last season, kept Reading in the Championship, but he left with the worst win percentage record of any Reading manager in their history, and yet they loved this guy because he kind of reconnected with the fans a little bit. They treated him to a Portugal day on the last day of the season to sort of say thank you. His dismissal wasn't popular either, and just the kind of standing of the guy who replaced him. And although Bowen obviously denies any part in either dismissal of Gomez or the appointment of himself, it was a peculiar episode. So Bowen was really delighted to get the 3 points, as I'm sure you can imagine, but he will need a lot more of them, I think, until the kind of perceptions are changed there.
Is there, I mean, it's been, as you mentioned, a troubling time at Reading of late. Is he, I mean, this is his first managerial job, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a risk, but they'll obviously be hoping that he can bring that stability back to a club that has been struggling of late.
Yeah, I mean, he spoke about the need for unity, and I think, you know, social media is not a good barometer, but that was not present when the announcement was made, and there was no real announcement of him as a new manager before kickoff either. It was just kind of washed over. But I think that's probably because the reaction might not have been that great. So look, he knows the only way he can get fans on side is by turning things around on the pitch, and it'll be interesting to see whether he can do that, because Reading have really struggled since reaching the Championship playoff final under Jaap Stam in 2017, penalty kicks really decided. Huddersfield went up and Reading stayed down. And ever since then, that was when the transaction took place between the Thai consortium and the Chinese owners as well. And really ever since then, the club has been in a downward spiral. So it's going to be a tough job to arrest that.
So it wasn't the best game, but I'm believing that there was a contender for flag of the season, possibly.
Yes. I mean, it wasn't connected to this, but it was Ricky Gervais, David Brent, the office character, obviously located in Slough down the road. A nice kind of picture of him with his cheesy grin and his fingers pointing at you saying, "Guilty, I'm a Reading fan," which was a line from the programme. So I was well amused by that, and that made its way into my intro, if you want to read it, listeners.
The Champions League is back this week, and we've just picked out two games involving English sides that we thought we might find a little bit interesting to look at. Tottenham take on Red Star Belgrade. Tottenham with just one win in seven in all competitions. As for Red Star Belgrade, they're in fine form, winning their last six in all competitions. James, this has got to be a must win, isn't it, for Tottenham in their Champions League hopes?
Well, yes, possibly. I mean, the only thing is you obviously hesitate to say must win because you remember how they started last season.
I know, that's it.
And they had
every
one point from,
it.
You know, three games. So, obviously, not just for the Champions League, their Champions League aspirations, but obviously just the kind of the wider mood around the club, the wider sense of a sort of, you know, terminal decline of this team. It looked obviously like you would have thought Watford at the weekend would have been, obviously the team at the bottom of the Premier League would have been a good opportunity for a kind of morale-boosting win, and obviously it very much did not work out like that. Obviously, you know, getting a late draw in what was a very kind of even game, one where they did not really kind of impose any sort of superiority. You know, I don't think Pochettino is going to be sacked if they lose, but, you know, it would only kind of help deepen the kind of sense of a sort of real tailspin at Tottenham.
That game at the weekend, it was a real opportunity for them to sort of regroup and go again as such, but it ended up being that one-all draw with Watford, and it was a very disappointing performance from Tottenham.
Yeah, I was reading Gary Jacobs' piece on the way in here, and the back five lost the ball 91 times, which kind of is not good. And I think, you know, we've spoken about the problems in great length, and there are just too many players whose kind of futures are uncertain, and the manager has helped cultivate that sort of discussion and the uncertainty even about his own future as well. So I agree with James. I don't think Pochettino is under pressure in terms of his job, but he's under pressure to show that he can kind of galvanise this group of players who seem to be really sort of lethargic and below par in the performance, and some of them are unhappy. It was really interesting listening to Jose Mourinho speaking in the Sky Sports studio yesterday about the fact that he'd never wanted any player who didn't want to be there. And he referenced Arjen Robben when Chelsea sold him to Real Madrid. And he said, you know, Chelsea did not want to sell him. They didn't need the money. I didn't want him to go either, but Robben wanted to go. And so they took the decision collectively that was the best thing for the club and for the team. And Tottenham have handled these decisions awfully, you know, on numerous occasions. Christian Eriksen is perhaps the latest. And also with players kind of drawn towards the end of the contract, either they have to bite the bullet sometimes and sell for a fee that they don't, that's perhaps lower than what they would expect, or they've not dealt with that situation. And I think that is really their biggest issue, which it's not going to go away between now and the end of the season. So that's what I mean. Pochettino has to show that he can kind of get over that obstacle, I think.
I think psychologically as well, the Champions League campaign assumes key importance in terms of motivation for this team, because we know they're out of the League Cup and they're already out of, you know, they're out of Premier League contention. All right, they want to kind of move themselves back up and get into the top four, but they're playing catch up, and from a motivational point of view, that's very different than going out to get something. And so the Champions League, if you like, until obviously, you know, the FA Cup, you know, the latter stages of the FA Cup, which we're a long, long way in the distance at the moment, the Champions League is, you know, from a psychological point of view, if they fall out of contention in the Champions League, if they, you know, can't qualify from the group stage, what can they really achieve this season? It's that kind of climb, you know, you've just got a long, long slate of Premier League fixtures stretching out ahead of you, you know, to get back into the top four, which is a position that you've already occupied, you know, it should be a kind of bare minimum requirement. It's not something that you're kind of really setting your sights on, if you know what I mean. So from a psychological point of view, I think this is really important that they kind of remain in the Champions League, just to have something to really kind of, to really fire them up and to
momentum,
really kind of,
yeah,
to really aspire to, momentum, that exactly, that old chestnut.
We do love that chestnut momentum indeed. So that is on Tuesday. Then on Wednesday, Chelsea head to Amsterdam to take on Ajax. When you look at the situation in Group H, Chelsea have 3 points after one win and one defeat. But as for Ajax, well, it's 6 points, two wins out of two for them. So, James, how tough a fixture is this for Chelsea?
Yeah, this is shaping up, I think, to be probably the toughest fixture of the group. We sort of weren't quite sure when at the start of the season, how formidable Ajax would be. They obviously lost some key players in the summer, Frankie de Jong and Matthijs de Ligt, but they really appear to have rebounded very well from those departures. They've been extremely impressive in their two Champions League games so far, both of which they won 3-0 against Valencia and Lille. Obviously, the team looks a little different. You've got Joël Veltman, who sort of played a little bit at right back in last season's Champions League campaign, has now come in to fill that gap that De Ligt has left at centre-back, and you've sort of got a new double pivot in the middle, which is made up of Edson Álvarez, the Mexican, and Lisandro Martinez, the Argentinian, both very, very young players, both converted centre-backs, sort of playing in that double pivot in midfield. The front four is still pretty much intact. The entire front four that kind of thrilled us last season of Van der Beek, Neres, Tadic and Hakim Ziyech are all still there. Quincy Promes has played as well. They look really the class of this group, and you know, this match is probably going to be Chelsea's toughest test of the group stage.
Well, that is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, James Gearbrand, Tom Roddy and Matt Dickinson.
Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet.
It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information, and we'll be back on Thursday looking back on a busy week of Champions League action.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk. thetimes.co.uk.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no,
I don't,
yes.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.